Conference materials and recordings are subject to all applicable copyright laws and are the intellectual property of the respective presenters. The content included in this online conference is licensed for the exclusive use of registered individuals or employees with authorized access as part of a site registration. This license does not authorize the resale, rebroadcast, duplication, or shared distribution of the handouts, recordings, or any other content contained herein. If you have questions, concerns, or are interested in making arrangements for authorized access, please contact Bow Valley College at 403-410-1526.
Wow.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to the final presentation in our second annual Upgrading Online Conference. This conference has been a wonderful opportunity for us to share some great ideas, some new initiatives, and to get to know each other a little better. My name is Murray Ronigan. I am the Online Humanities Instructor at Bow Valley College, and I really hope that this has been a helpful and truly collegial experience for everyone, and I look forward to this annual initiative continuing long into the future. There is much to celebrate, as my colleague and friend Carrie Hillgardner is fond of saying. We are now wrapping up our conference with the session 601, the closing keynote presentation titled The Role of Open Educational Resources in Personal Learning, presented by Stephen Downs. In his session, you will hear Stephen's thoughts on open educational resources and the role they play in the development of learning networks. Stephen Downs is a senior researcher for Canada's National Research Council and a leading proponent of the use of online media and services in education. He is the author of the widely read OL Daily online newsletter. For those who don't subscribe to this fascinating offering that has been called the gold standard in online information, then make a note to do it right away. I read it every day, and its usefulness is really hard to overestimate. Stephen Downs has earned international recognition for his leading-edge work in the field of online learning and has authored one of the richest, most informative texts available, titled The Future of Online Learning. He has built a learning and research portal for the municipal sector in Alberta called Nunimal, and another for the engineering and geology sector called Pegasus. He is one of the first adopters and developers of RSS content syndication in education and has developed some of Canada's first online courses while at Brandon's Assiniboine Community College. Stephen introduced the concept of e-learning 2.0 and developed and defined the concept of connectivism and used the social network approach to deliver open online courses to 3,000 participants. Stephen has been offering courses in learning, logic, philosophy, both online and off, since 1987. He has published over 135 articles in books, magazines, and academic journals, and presented his distinctive perspective on learning and technology more than 250 times to audiences in 17 countries on 5 continents. He is an habitual photographer. I saw this most recent shot on Monday's OL Daily and included it here. Spring looks good in Spain. Stephen Downs lives in Moncton, New Brunswick, with his wife Andrea and 4 cats. I'm very glad that you were able to take some time out of your Spanish trip to be with us, Stephen, and let me share the warmest welcome we can send to someone enjoying spring in the Pyrenees. It is a pleasure to turn it over to you whenever you are ready.
Well, thank you very much, and let me just pop up my camera here so that you can see me. You've already seen me already, but anyhow, now you can see me again. I'm not, as you can see from the background, in Spain anymore. I returned home late last night, or early this morning, depending on how you want to count these things. So, you're not getting a presentation from Spain. You're getting a presentation on jet lag day, the day after a return from the trip to Spain. You should be hearing sound. I'm seeing a comment from Bethany saying there's no sound. However, we're getting sound from other people. So the very first thing I want to do, especially given that this is a talk about open educational resources is I want to counter the disclaimer that frightened me as this session opened. I don't know if you heard it. It was very loud and said all kinds of things about how this was all private and cannot be shared. You can share this presentation all you want. This presentation is mine, and if you want to share it with people, go ahead and share it. No problem at all. I should have probably put a Creative Commons license on it, although everything on my website is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-alike license. So don't feel inhibited from sharing this stuff. I do want to talk about the role of open educational resources in personal learning. I also want to talk about what they mean in personal learning. I have a challenging presentation ahead, one that I think will make you think, I hope will make you think, and rethink just what it is that we're up to when we take resources like this presentation with all the popping peas and the pictures and the words and all of that, and put them online or present them in a Connect workshop, just what it is that's happening there, what it is that we're up to. I have to remember, because I am broadcasting my camera, not to shut my eyes, because normally when I do a presentation online, it's sort of funny, I find myself shutting my eyes because it's easier. But if you're watching me on camera, here I am speaking to you on camera with my eyes shut, which is very strange. I never noticed that before. Anyhow, never mind. Ground rules, there are no ground rules. If you have questions, pop them up in the chat area. If you have an urgent need to speak, I assume that there are mechanisms that will allow anyone to speak, and I will happily give up the microphone and let you have your urgent need to speak, and all you need to do is express that urgent need to speak in some way, like, say, raising your hand or lowering your hand. And one of the other moderators will be monitoring this, I hope, because it's hard to give a talk and monitor for speaking at the same time. I will be watching, but I'm hoping that the other moderators can help out. Okay, that said, let's move on into this presentation. So, here's the argument in one slide. And the argument from my perspective really is very simple. Learning and cognition, oh, the moderators are on the job. Excellent. Learning and cognition happen in a network. And I could go on and on and on and on about what that means. But basically, first of all, learning happens in your brain. Your brain is composed of a network of neurons, interconnected neurons. And learning happens in a society, and society is composed of a bunch of interconnected people. We can depict both of those as networks. And they are networks. The second thing is, networks need to be open in order to function. You see the nice little picture of a network on the screen here. If those connections between the nodes or the entities in the network are broken, are blocked, then that network ceases to function. In order to function, communication has to take place from node to node, and this communication needs to be unobstructed. If the communication is obstructed, this is a network failure. So, the argument for open educational resources is simply networks need openness in order to function. So we're all done. We can all go home now. Well, nothing's that simple. Oh, good. My arrow key works. What does it mean to say that our network is open? I'm still popping my peas here. There. That should be better. And I think that volume is a bit... Yeah, you see, the trick is to not have the microphone in front of the airflow, and that way I can get the volume, but I'm not popping. See, and I can't even pop my peas now. Oh, the little tricks to this sort of thing. If I was a pilot, I'd have a throat microphone. Yeah, never mind. Okay, what is openness? Well, there's Richard Stallman pictured, and if you follow the video, he's singing the open software song, or the free software song, I guess, more accurately. And the traditional definition of open source has four elements: freedom to run the software, freedom to read the source code, freedom to share the software, freedom to modify the software. And this is a definition that has carried over into the open educational resources movement. And it's a definition, I think, that we need to challenge, because we need to consider what the perspectives are on this freedom. When people talk about open source software, they talk about openness and freedom from the perspective of the person who already has the software, who has it in their hands, and wants to do things with it, like read it, share it, modify it, whatever. And anything that restricts what they do with it is considered an infringement on the freedom. But what if you're a person who does not have the software and needs the software? Well, now our definition of freedom begins to change a little bit, because from the perspective of someone who does not have the software, freedom would be open access to the software with no infringements. Anything that infringes on that open access is a restriction on the freedom. And the difference between these two models comes to a head when we talk about commercial use. If you own the software, then you should be able to sell it. And if somebody says you can't sell it, that's a restriction. But if you don't have the software, somebody who's trying to sell it to you rather than actually giving it to you is creating a restriction. So you have different kinds of open depending on your perspective. So the question is, what is the correct perspective to be looking at, or looking at the issue from, in the context of learning, and online learning in particular? Well, David Wiley has spoken about open educational resources for many, many years. He's one of the pioneers in the field. He came up with one of the first open content licenses. He talks about openness in standards, and he's, again, one of the early pioneers in things like learning objects and learning object metadata. He talks about openness in software, and then he talks about openness in systems, like open courses. George Siemens and I, in our work offering online courses, have depicted the progression of openness in three major stages. First of all, openness in educational resources. Secondly, open courses. And then third, and as yet unrealized type of openness in assessment. There are other kinds of openness. I was reading something from Sir John Daniel, the former president of the United Kingdom's Open University, talking about openness as related to openness of access or admission to a university program, open resources, and then openness in being able to determine your own educational progression, your own course of studies. So there are these different dimensions of openness that we can talk about, different ways of describing the same concept. Well, I'm going to go through just those six that I listed in the previous slide. The open standards, and I'm not going to linger on this because we could spend a lifetime talking about standards. In education, there's a variety of standards intended to facilitate how we describe, how we discover, and how we reuse educational resources. The grandfather of these is called Learning Object Metadata, or LOM, created originally by the aviation CBT Aviation Industry Computer-Based Training Committee, AICC, and then passed on by Instructional Management Systems, or IMS, and then standardized under the IEEE, and then really, really, really standardized under the ISO standards-based organizations. But there are other standards as well. Learning design, common cartridge, learning tools, interoperability. The United States military, under the auspices of something called Advanced Distributed Learning, came out with the Shareable Courseware Object Reference Model, or SCORM, which is the standard in commercial online learning. These standards have all had kind of a murky history. They're sort of open, they're sort of not open, they're sort of proprietary, they're sort of not proprietary. IMS, for example, supports itself with a membership system. If you pay them several thousands of dollars more if you're bigger, then you have access to the standards ahead of time. I think that it's about a year ahead of time. And so you can make all of your products line up with the standards, and everybody else has to wait until IMS formally releases them. IEEE, by contrast, will release the standards openly while they're still being discussed and decided upon, but once IEEE settles on the formal specification, it then removes it from its website and you have to pay them for it. So openness is really murky, as I said, with respect to standards. In my world, the best kind of standards are the ones that are completely open without encumbrances, which is why, out of all of these, I've tended to favor none of them and instead favored things like RSS or even Dublin Core, which are much more open and much more freely used. Open source software has had a significant impact on online learning. I imagine most of the people in this session are familiar with Moodle, which is a PHP-based open source learning management system created originally by Martin Doug UMass and then thousands of volunteer programmers. Moodle is small, portable, and useful for colleges and schools. Another learning management system that was developed as open source software, Sakai, is exactly not that. It's Java-based, it's enterprise, it was built by a consortium of universities as part of MIT's Open Knowledge Initiative. There's ELG, which doesn't actually stand for anything, which is an open sourced social network software for learning. A-Tutor, LAMS, Learning Activity Management System, more types of software available at SchoolForge, and so on. And all of these are released under one or another type of open source license. If you're not sure about open source licenses, really, and I'm going to horribly overgeneralize here, that world breaks down into two kind of worlds. One, the world where the open source license allows commercial development, and the other, the GPL world, where it doesn't allow commercial development. Like I said, that's a grandiose overgeneralization. If you want to follow that up, we can, but it's a bit off topic. More specific to our agenda today are the open educational resource projects themselves. Here I list just a few of them. Probably one of the earlier ones, and certainly the most famous and most heavily promoted, is MIT's OpenCourseWare project. Something that's also received a lot of attention recently because he appeared on TED videos is the Khan Academy, which is a whole series of YouTube videos on mathematics, physics, and similar science and technology type subjects. Merlot is a project that was created by a consortium of North American educational institutions. And I could go on. There are dozens of projects that have been set up specifically to create educational materials for distribution for free, or some version of free, to people around the world. The licensing of these resources, in order to make them available for use and reuse, used to be based on something called the GNU Free Documentation License. That was the license that accompanied open source software originally. You'd have the software, which was licensed under, say, GPL, or some other open source license, and then the documentation that came along with the software had its own license. More recently, we've had Creative Commons, and Creative Commons is now the dominant mechanism for licensing open educational resources, for licensing open content of any sort. Creative Commons is pretty neat, and devised by Lawrence Lessig, actually provides the licensor, the person who owns the material, with a series of choices. And the person may apply some restriction to the license of the material. For example, CC BY. That requires that the person who uses the content attribute the content to whoever wrote it in the first place. So if you use my content and I've applied the BY condition, you have to say this content was by Stephen Downs. Share alike means that if you share the content, you must share it under the same license that you got the content. Non-commercial means that you cannot use the content to make money, and we can talk about that in more detail. Non-derivatives means that you have to use the content as it was created. You can't take the content and do a whole bunch of stuff to it and effectively create derivative materials from it. By far the most popular form of Creative Commons license is the one that I use, Creative Commons BY Non-Commercial Share Alike. So I want to be attributed. I don't want it to be used commercially, and I want it to be shared under the same license that it was obtained under. A lot of people in the open education resource community say, well, the non-commercial condition means that the content isn't really free, because if it was really free, then you should be able to charge money for it. But again, this is the perspective issue again. If I don't have the content and want the content, and some guy's charging money for it, it's not free. It's not free in any sense of the word. It's not free in the sense that I don't have to pay for it, but it's also not free in the sense that I can't use it if I don't have the money. I just don't have access to it. The response from the defenders of free, as including commercial use, has always been, well, you know, the content's always available for free somewhere. Ooh, my picture moved. That was funny. And the moderator's on the move. You know, so it doesn't matter if, say, Penguin sells a copy of Beowulf. Beowulf's in the public domain. You can always get it for free somewhere else. But in fact, abusing their power, yeah. In fact, in my opinion, it's not so simple as that. That when there is commercial use of free resources, there is all kinds of motivation to not use or not allow free use of these resources. So even if theoretically it's the case that there could be free copies of Beowulf hanging around, the commercial publishers of Beowulf, the $4.95 version, have all kinds of ways of making sure you just can't get at it. And this creates an entire infrastructure for creating open content and then managing somehow to charge for open content, which to me sort of goes entirely against the whole concept. I did a study, I guess it was in 2006, I did this study on models of sustainable open educational resources. And what I found was that most of the projects that produce open educational resources are publishing projects. The resources are coming out of either commercial publishing houses or universities, which traditionally feed materials into commercial publishing houses, or foundations. And the different models for the sustainability of open educational resources were all based around that paradigm. So, for example, you have the endowment model. This model is used by the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. And what you do is you take a big chunk of money, you put it aside, and then you get interest on that money every year, and you use the interest to publish your resource, which worked really well until the stock market crashed. Then there's the membership model, and that's the model I described earlier for IMS, where you charge memberships and people can join your consortium and participate in the creation of the resource. But you know, when people pay for memberships, they usually expect privileges, and that typically means some sort of privileged access. Another model is the donation model. We see Wikipedia using that donation model. National Public Radio uses the donation model. And again, it's based on this idea of there will be some organization that does some publishing, although Wikipedia is probably the one that least fits into that model. NPR definitely fits into that model. But even if you have these free resources hanging around, commercial publishers still manage to get you to pay for them. And there's a variety of ways they do this. Lock-in, for example, is if they lock you into a certain technology, such as, say, iTunes or the Kindle, then the material which would normally be available for free is, within that environment, only available at a price. Or another way of making it very difficult to get free materials is to set what might be called a high bar for free content. You pose conditions, for example, learning object metadata, which has 87 or whatever fields that must be filled in order for it to be registered. A commercial publisher can hire some guy to go sit there and fill in metadata fields, but free content providers don't have that kind of resource. And so the requirement that content have metadata attached to it creates this high bar that free content can't get over. And so the only version of the content you're going to get is the version where somebody sat down and paid somebody to create metadata. Another way of making you access the commercial content rather than the free content is flooding. This is what Starbucks does. Starbucks, when they want to move into a community, they look at the downtown area, see, you know, 3 or 4 square blocks, they put 25 stores in there. And you might think, that's ridiculous. No area needs 25 Starbucks, and it's true. But what happens is they put 25 Starbucks in, that drives out all the other competition. Nobody can compete. And then once Starbucks has the only coffee stores in the area, now they can start closing stores, raising prices, kicking people out if they're hanging around on the nice sofas, etc. In the world of software, we see this. Well, one example is with the commercial versions of Wikipedia. Wikipedia has one of these licenses where you can create a commercial version of it. But I like Starbucks. You like Starbucks because there's no other choice. If you actually tried the other choices, you'd probably find you don't like burnt, overpriced coffee. Sorry, just a tirade. Yeah, that's not even coffee. That's a sugar snack. All right, nothing like debating the people in the chat room. Where was I? Oh yeah, flooding. So there are these commercial versions of Wikipedia, and what they do is they take Wikipedia content, put it in a little tiny content window in the middle of the screen, and surround it with advertisements. The more flashing and annoying, the better. And it used to be the case, it's not now because Google stepped in, but it used to be the case that if you did a search for a topic that was covered under Wikipedia, you couldn't find the Wikipedia article. All you'd hit were these commercial versions because they can afford to pay for search engine optimization and Wikipedia can't. Now, over time, Google stepped in and, you know, like the hand of God reaching down, elevated Wikipedia up in the search rank, so this doesn't work anymore for Wikipedia. But it still works for all the other kinds of free content that Google doesn't elevate. It's just, you don't notice that. But if you go back, next time you do a search on Google, look at the listings and ask yourself, how is it that these five are at the top of the list. They've been search engine optimized, and they're almost certainly, if they're not Wikipedia, they're almost certainly going to be commercial, commercial content of some sort. We love Google. I love Google too. I hate search engine optimization. Sorry, I actually banged my desk there. There's also conversion. That's where you give somebody a free resource and then you convert it to a commercial resource and get them to pay you money for it because they've become so addicted to your free resource that they can't bear to be without it. Love, hate, such strong words. Yeah. Okay. So you can see, and you can disagree with the details of this, but you can see there's this whole economy of free, of commercial, of publishing, of subscriptions, this whole infrastructure which is surrounding the idea of putatively open educational content. It's open educational content to a degree with restrictions, if circumstances permit, using certain technologies. Otherwise, we're strangled in this whole, well, as the picture goes, the industrialization, work, images, etc. Now, that's the story of open educational resources. Now I'm going to change gears. I'm going to change gears really dramatically. And what I want to propose to you is that, oh, thank you, I was just about to do that, is that on the internet now, the new media that people use, and there's a whole range, right? Everything from little cartoons like we see here, to videos, to animations, to those Flash games, to the memes that go around, to Twitter hashtags and all of that. All of these new media constitute a vocabulary. And that when people create artifacts in this new media, they are quite literally speaking in lolcats. For those of you who are not familiar, a lolcat, lol of course stands, oh, that's because there's a space. The link on the slide doesn't work because there's a space between the 4 and the 6 and there shouldn't be. Sorry. That's an artifact of the conversion, I would think. Anyhow, a lolcat is typically a photograph, a digital photograph, preferably of a cat, with a funny saying on it. And the original is a picture of a cat smiling, looking very smug, looking up at you saying, "I can has cheeseburger." And there's a whole ethos that goes into lolcats. There's bad grammar, there's tying into contemporary memes, contemporary ideas. Cheshire Cat, very good. Thanks for posting the link there in the chat, Carrie. And any of you who've spent any amount of time online know about these, especially these days. The YouTube videos are almost the dominant memes. And even if you don't spend time online, if you watch CTV News, I forget his name, the weather reporter, does this, I watch videos so you don't have to, and he shows these cute videos. All of these are instances of people, if you will, speaking in lolcats. Lolcats, or any of these media, are far more than just the image and the words. Here we have a cartoon, one of my favorites. It's XKCD. If you're not familiar with it, totally go check this out. The guy's brilliant. And it's a neat little story about all the tech things the person does in order to contact somebody who is inside the locked room. And, of course, you can read the comic for yourself. But is that all the comic is saying? What are the messages? What are the meanings behind the comic? Here's an instance of something called Gaping Void. And this guy made a name for himself drawing little cartoons on the back of business cards. They don't always mean a whole lot, but then he started putting them up online and they started getting shared a lot. And very interesting. So, you know, with each one of these, we can ask, what is the person saying? What is a person saying when they take one of his little business cards and put it on their own website? Here's something that was popular not long after 9/11. Some said too soon. As you can see, it's the guy now known as Tourist Guy. They often get generic names like that. He's photographed, of course, on top of the World Trade Center, and you can see the airplane in the background. And this is characteristic of this sort of media manipulation where you take two photos, one of an airplane, one of a guy on top of the World Trade Center, and put them together to create some sort of odd statement. And of course, once one of these things gets going, it really gets going. There's Tourist Guy in front of the Hindenburg. And there's Tourist Guy, and the plane is still there, but now you have Kanye West jumping in to say that Pearl Harbor was the greatest attack, not the... Anyhow. And you can see here how the memes, the concepts, the ideas, the images merge, remerge, fold over each other, shape and create new kinds of meaning. And then people share them. And when they share them, they're creating some kind of meaning out of that too, aren't they? Because they don't do it for no reason. It's not rational to suppose that they do it for no reason. These are languages. This sharing of this resource is the expression of meaning in a language. And there are all kinds of languages. These digital photographs, these videos and that, are just a few of the many, many languages we use in everyday discourse. Body language, for example. Everybody reads body language, some better than others. Me, I'm practically illiterate in body language, but people have their strengths. Clothing, uniforms, flags. We've been watching the Libya thing. One of the very first things that they did is they revived the old Libyan flag, the red, green, and black flag with the crescent and the star symbol on it. These things have meanings. The hats, the head garb that people wear have meanings. The drapery in the back of the room has meaning. You know, how many people belong to the jeans and t-shirt set? That's almost a uniform. Maps, diagrams, graphics have meaning. And they don't necessarily have literal meaning. Here we have a graph of the social network environment from 2007. And what it's doing is using the language of maps in order to talk about something that is very much not mappable. Well, except that it is mappable, because here's a map of it. What I'm saying is that this sort of thing underlies our thought processes in general. This is a picture on this slide of a drawing on a cave wall in Kakadu National Park. I took this photograph in 2004, and if you look at it really closely, it's a fish and fish guts. And you might ask, why would an Aboriginal draw a painting of fish guts on a cave wall? And the answer, of course, is that he, assume it's a he, it's probably a he, wanted to communicate something about fish guts to other people, and this was the mechanism for doing it. And, you know, it was probably a description of what you'll find inside a fish, what you can eat, what you can't eat, etc. You know, whatever was important about fish to them. And we do this in general, that we use these I don't want to say representations because that's too strong a word, but we use these signs to communicate with each other. The lolcats, the YouTube videos, cave paintings on the wall, the body language, the maps, all of these are functioning in the same way. Which means that when we're talking about media and we're talking about communication, we have to get beyond talking the way we talk about text and books and chapters and papers and publications. We have to get beyond that very narrow discussion because communication actually occurs in many, many other forms. And when we talk about ways we communicate as being simply text and books and publishers and things like that, we're talking about only a very small, narrow segment of it. So, what is this kind of talk that we need to get away from? Well, think about the assumptions that you may have had, not only about educational resources, but about communications in general. Something like, messages have a sender and a receiver. Well, in the world of the internet, that makes no sense. It really doesn't. Why did you publish that picture of a cat with a hat on? Because I could. Who did you send it to? Well, I don't know. Or conceptions like, words get meaning from what they represent. Not so. Words, anything, gets meaning from pretty much anything. Oh, guess who just jumped up? Hi, Alex. Sorry. You jump up on my desk, you go on camera. Truth is based on the real world. Events have a cause, and causes can be known. Science is based on forming and testing hypotheses. All of these are things that are true in this static, linear, coherent, text-based, semiotic-based picture of the world. But it's a picture that, even if it was once correct, is no longer correct. The world is just no longer like that. And this very point, this very distinction, is the distinction between what we might say are old and new depictions of open educational resources, or educational resources generally. Makes it very hard. The picture that I presented to you earlier of open educational resources as things that are published, things that are presented by publishers in a very formal manner, probably charged for in commercial, that's the old static, linear, coherent picture of the world. It's not the model that we want to use for open educational resources. I'm leaning over the cat to find my arrow key. We need to think about open educational resources not as content, but as language. We need to stop treating open educational resources or online resources generally as though they were content like books, magazines, articles, because the people who actually use them, the students and very often the creators, have moved far beyond that. Each one of these things is a word, if you will, in this very large post-linguistic vocabulary. They are now language. They are not composed of language, they are language. And that's why they need to be open. Think about it for a second. Suppose that everyday words that you wanted to use, like, say, cat, just to pick a word at random, were owned by, say, Coca-Cola. Now, we have allowed a certain limited ownership of words in our society, but by and large, you can't own words. You can't own expression. And even more particularly, imagine if you had to pay royalties to use certain letters. So you can only use the letter O if you paid money to Ford. And you can only use the letter I if you paid money to, well, Apple, obviously. Yeah, the effectiveness of language would be significantly impaired. And the thesis here is that the effectiveness of language would be impaired in exactly the same way the effectiveness of communication would be impaired in exactly the same way that the effectiveness of a network is impaired if you break down or block the links between entities. Doing this with a cat on the desk is very difficult. So how do we understand this new media? What, I don't want to say skills, but what do we need to know in order to know how to deal with these open educational resources, with these online resources in generally? Because, you know, I mean, if it's a language, there's going to be linguistic elements. We know who rules in your home. Yeah, and you know what's scary? We have four cats. This could have been any given cat on any given Sunday, any given cat. Anyhow, speaking of memes, I've come up with this frame. It borrows from Charles Morris, who gives us syntax, semantics, and pragmatics, Derrida a little bit, Lao Tzu a little bit. Yeah, my cat used to love the fax machine. I had my cat sending long-distance fax messages to people around the world. Not good. Not good. You talk about your cat being an unnecessary expense. A cat that sends faxes around the world. Very definitely an unnecessary expense. Syntax is basically our understanding of the shapes that things can take. It's not just rules and grammar. Rules and grammar is a way of talking about language and linguistic expression, text-based expression. Syntax can be archetypes, can be Platonic ideals, can be grammar, can be logical syntax, procedures, motor skills, operations, patterns, regularities, substitutivity, acorns and tropes, etc. Any of those words is well worth looking up. You know, we think of rules of language, and it's funny because we think that the rule tells us what to do, but the rule really is just a pattern and has come to be a rule because we've observed it over and over and over. Cause and effect is like that. And the skill here is in seeing and recognizing these patterns. Recognizing them and then being able to manipulate them. A guy called Saul Alinsky wrote a book called Rule Book for Radicals. One of the things he said was use their own rules against them. Because, you know, the established order has ways of doing things, and if you follow the ways of doing things, you can actually subvert the established order. But the trick here is to see what those rules are and then be able to manipulate those rules to your own advantage. Substitutivity, yeah, exactly. I'm reading you. Okay, I don't want to. The principle that expressions with the same reference can be substituted for one another without affecting the truth value in any context in which they occur. Yes. Oh, very. And Kerry's doing, I guess, quick Google lookups. Or Wikipedia lookups. Very good. Semantics. Not just theories of truth, because the minute you get into theories of truth, you get into all kinds of things, all kinds of issues. What makes a sentence true? What makes a picture true? What makes a cartoon true? I look at Family Circus and I nod to myself and say, true. And I know that the characters depicted in Family Circus are completely fictional. In what sense, then, am I saying it's true? Not just that, though. What is the meaning, the purpose, or the goal of a communications artifact? The connotation or implication of what was said. You know, if I send you a picture of a very large turkey, I'm not telling you to go get a turkey. I might not even be calling you a turkey. But depending on our context, there might be some shared meaning between that. Semantics may be based in interpretation. It may be based in frequency. It may be based on what we're willing to bet. Frank Ramsey came up with a theory of probability based on how much you're willing to wager. The probability P is 4 if you're willing to wager $4 to get $1 back. Forms of association, contiguity, backpropagation, meaning, semantics in networks. Decision theory, you talk to the political and economists, they will time and time again go back to a worldview based on decisions and decision theory. Three strikes in a row, bowling reference.
Yeah.
Baseball?
Yeah.
Very good. Yeah. Pragmatics. Use, actions, impact. A guy called J.L. Austin wrote a book called How to Do Things with Words. You know, when people talk about freedom of speech, usually they mean freedom of expression, not freedom of doing. But, you know, there's so much with speech that we actually do. You know, you stand at the altar, you say, I do. You're not just making a statement, but you're actually committing an act. When you ask a question, you're not simply uttering some words, but you're creating this expectation of a response. You can do things like harass, incite to violence, etc. Wittgenstein said meaning itself is based on use. Cognition is another element of this framework. I've defined cognition in four major areas. Other people may do it differently, which is fine. Description, definition, argument, and explanation. And basically what cognition means is the way we transition from one thing to another thing to another thing in our language. It's about the inferences that we make, the explanations that we make, how we go beyond a mere statement of what is to a statement of what must be, what could be, what may be, what we ought to do, what we ought to think, etc. Context has to do with environment, placement, localization, language, culture, reference. A lot of late 20th century philosophy was based on discovering the contextual sensitivity to everyday things. Explanation, for example, explored by people like Hansen and Van Frassen. If you say the roses have grown well, or you know, you ask why have the roses grown well, what you mean is, why have the roses grown well instead of grown poorly? Or why have the roses grown well instead of tulips? Or why have the roses grown well instead of aliens landing from outer space? The answer we get when we ask for an explanation depends on what we thought the alternatives were. And that's context. Same thing with meaning. Willard Van Orman Quine explores the question of meaning, the possible range of translations that could take place if we encounter a new language for the first time. Girarda explores the alternatives in a vocabulary space, frames as described by George Lakoff, etc. All of these constitute an understanding of context. And then finally, change. Many different ways of depicting change, ranging from old Taoism, the I Ching, logical relation to flow, the idea of change as being directional, change as being manifest in history. Marshall McLuhan examining the four aspects of change. Logic is a study of change. Gaming theory, simulations, and that sort of environment is a theory of change. Scheduling, timetabling, activity theory, learning as a network, all of that is looking at things as based in change. So if we take all of this together, let's bring this, wrap this all sort of up. I said sort of up. Never mind, I'm jet lagged. We typically think of knowing, learning, if we don't think of it as retaining content, and I think most people don't anymore, but they think of it as acquiring skills. Henry Jenkins describes skills like performance and simulation and appropriation, etc. But these things are all actually languages and should be understood in these six dimensions. And any of the things that we're trying to teach people, any of the things, science, mathematics, social studies, Egyptian philosophy, whatever, should be understood as one of these languages and understood in that frame. So here's an example of that frame using Jenkins' skills, right? So we have performance, simulation, and appropriation. In a performance, there are the elements of syntax, semantics, pragmatics, etc. And then for each one of these boxes, we can analyze what the details are of that aspect of that language. So what is the syntax of performance, for example? Well, I mean, there's the different forms, patterns, rule systems, operations, similarities in performance. From something very simple to such as knowing your lines to the presentation acting, method acting, Stanislavski's system. I don't know anything about acting and performance, so I just pulled stuff from the literature, ritual performance, all of these different ways of formalizing performance, and that constitutes ways of understanding performance. So this reaches the third and final thesis. Fluency in these languages constitutes 21st century learning. Being able to speak and write and perform and act and share and whatever, these different languages constitutes learning in the 21st century. We used to think it was just acquiring content, and then we used to think it was acquiring skill, but it's much more involved in that. It's actually being fluent in these languages, where being fluent means mastering or being capable in the semantics, the syntax, the pragmatics, the context, etc., of these different languages. And that brings us back to what we want to think about in open educational resources. Open educational resources is a network. I don't even want to say it that way because that trivializes it. Open educational resources are individually the words that we use in whatever vocabulary we're using to conduct whatever activity it is that we're using or that we're undertaking. They are the signals that we send to each other in a network. If that is so, then what openness means in the context of open educational resource, in the context of open educational resources, is whatever is meant by openness in a network, where we think of openness in a network as the sending of these signals back and forth, the sending of these resources back and forth. I think of openness in a network, I come up with four major dimensions. There may be others. I don't claim to be authoritative on this or even original, but these are the ones that I see. Autonomy. Each entity in the network is self-governing. Diversity. The entities in the network are encouraged to have different states, to read different things, have different opinions, say different things. Openness, in the sense that signals can be sent freely from one entity to another, that entities have access to signals that are sent from one entity to another, that membership in the network itself is open and fluid. And then finally, interactivity. That what is learned by the network is not what is constituted in the signals that are sent back and forth, but rather what is created by the network as a whole that is emergent from the activities that the network undertakes. What I mean by that is what is learned by a brain, for example, is not a bunch of electrical impulses. That doesn't make sense. What is learned by a brain is what emerges when these impulses are sent back and forth between 10 or 100 billion neurons. What is learned is greater than the content of the individual messages. And that's key and crucial to understanding open educational resources. The resources are not contents we expect people to assimilate. The contents of these resources is not the learning. The learning is what happens when you take these resources and start interacting with them in a network. That's the basis that George Siemens and I used to create the massive open online courses, which I won't really have a chance to talk about in any great detail today. But the idea of these courses was that, and is that, we provide as much material for conversation as possible and set up this conversational network where the exchange of this material can take place. So the course itself becomes a network. The open educational resources are the concepts, the words, the vocabulary that people in this network use to communicate with each other. And that's in fact exactly what happens. Somebody signs up for the course, they start reading stuff being sent by other people. I have another cat and I'm hiding my iPod from her because she eats iPod earbuds. That's the syntax of cat ownership. So the idea is that we create this network, enable people to communicate using these open educational resources within this network, and the learning people undertake is not the content of these resources, but whatever they learn as a consequence of interacting with other people in this network using these resources. And so I've described a process, and again, it's one of these things, you know, there's four easy steps: aggregate, remix, repurpose, feed forward. So this is the process that we recommend to people. Nothing is required in one of these courses, but this is what we recommend as the four major steps of working with these resources. You gather these resources, you remix them, join them together, mash them up, repurpose them, localize them, adapt them, mark them up, tag them, review them, lip-dub them, do whatever with them, and then send them forward, communicate them to other people in the network. That's where we stand now with open educational resources and open learning. And there's a whole world ahead. Our capacity for languages has greatly expanded in the last 20 years. In the next 20 years, it is going to expand again. We haven't even touched in a serious way on the internet the whole idea of big data, the web of data, sensor networks. We may have 2 billion people online. Imagine adding to the internet 20 billion sensors, machines, and other things that can send signals in. There's the whole ways of representing information from the semantic web, RSS, geography, friend of a friend, so on. Excuse me. A whole open learning ecosystem, and not just a smallish network, still waiting to be grown. People are using more and more complex words in this new language. And we're finding that we don't need the publishers, we don't even need the academics in many cases, to create these resources. And insofar as the publishers and the academics create these resources in the old linear, static, linguistic, traditional manner, they're speaking at cross purposes in any case to the new form of learning that's happening now. The idea of using these resources to learn has as much to do with creating these resources as consuming these resources. And it's in the creation of these resources that we acquire the greater capacities and skills that we need in order to function in this environment. And that's where I leave it now. It's a story unfinished. It's a story of communities still finding themselves and forming themselves, languages half written, unwritten, undeveloped, partially developed, an ecosystem beginning to grow, and the challenge ahead. So any questions, comments, I'd be more than happy to take them at this point. I'm running out of speaking voice too. Could you get me coffee, please? Please?
Thank you very much for this, Stephen. This was a powerful and truly challenging, rich presentation, not a standard linear text-based vision of our world. Autonomy, diversity, openness, interactivity, all this in a friendly, intrusive cat, too.
Yeah.
As a token of our appreciation, we have a gift certificate for you that we'll send you shortly. Thanks again for this, Stephen, and we're glad you got back home safely. Stay in touch. There is a feedback survey coming up, and there is some good news for two of our participants who will be receiving a Google package as a present for participating today. They are Laura Bassard and Carolyn Marshall. Let's take a final moment for a special thank you to the following organizations who have helped out with this conference: eCampus Alberta, the Teaching and Learning Center at Bow Valley College, the Center for Foundational Learning at Bow Valley College, Alberta North Campus, BC Campus, and Northwest College. And a special thanks to the great people at Bow Valley College's Teaching and Learning Commons, Laura, Karen, and Peter. It's also a big vote of thanks to Carolyn Marshall and Diane Hendrickson from Northwest College. And finally, thank you to Lindsay Bonifant, Tracy Black, and of course the irrepressible Carrie Hilgartner, who is a huge part of making this annual conference work and grow. Thank you all again, and stay with us a bit longer to complete a feedback survey.
Oh, cool. I can vote on my own presentation.